You're listening to the Coconetics Podcast. Episode 26 for Saturday, February 25th. iOS Dev Weekly. Dave Verwer lets us peek behind the scenes of the iOS Dev Weekly newsletter. Apple sold more iOS devices in 2011 than Macs ever before, and we learn what an NS inception is. But first, a bit of the news. If you are in Germany, you might find that your iCloud push email does not work anymore. The reason for this is that Motorola Mobility won an injunction against Apple there that forced them to disable push. A support page exists saying that Apple thinks the patent is in question is invalid and is fighting it. In the meantime, your options are to either leave Germany or enable pulling as detailed in the Knowledge Base article. LLDB replaces GDB as the default debugger as of Xcode 4.3. Mugunth Kumar was the first to mention LLDB now supports typing dot notation. You can type PO self.myobject.name instead of PO ; self space my object ; space name ; dot. Finally! Because it's been quite tedious if you were inspecting objects on the GDB command line to have to do the square bracket dance. Now with the dot notation, as you are used to using it when programming, it's much more convenient. And as I said, as of Xcode 4.3, LLDB is the standard for new projects. You can switch which debugger you use in the project settings. Carl Brown distilled the learnings from his Mac App Store review down to some great items. I put the link in my show notes. And the main points are: you can't require third-party apps to be installed. The first rule of Sandbox is you don't talk about Sandbox. There's a statement in the review guidelines, 3.3, apps with descriptions not relevant to the application content and functionality will be rejected. So you should think about what you put into the descriptions for your apps. If you write something that doesn't have to do with the functionality, like implemented Sandbox, then that might be a rejection reason. Third item, they are serious about keeping the user informed. He once got rejected for not presenting a progress bar. So if you have a situation where something might take some time, you have to inform the user that something is going on. You're waiting for some file to download or so, maybe show a progress bar, because otherwise the rejection reason that they like to slap on the rejection is might lead to customer confusion. And he also got rejected once because he didn't specify a minimum window size. You know, on Mac, Windows can have a minimum size below which you can't resize the image, the view. Unfortunately, if you don't specify this, you can make it so small that you cannot use the app anymore. And he got rejected once because of that. Regarding the App Store review process, fake scam apps are all the rage. Apple has the rule in the review guidelines that you have to have the appropriate rights for what you put in apps. Nevertheless, there are always some passing inspection that don't. Like a Pokemon Yellow game. Nintendo would never let themselves be caught making iOS apps. The sad thing really was that these were just slideshows. But still, these developers don't even have the rights for screenshots of Nintendo games. Only Nintendo does. But Apple doesn't seem to really care. They let the original rights holders police the App Store for them. So these apps will be in the store until the actual rights holder makes a complaint, and Apple will then more or less forward the complaint and ask the people to work it out. I once had a situation like this myself. I had made a game that was sort of loosely based on the idea of a Wheel of Fortune. In my case, that went well for like 2 years until Sony Entertainment called Apple basically and told them, I am a copyright pirate. And so what happened is Apple asked me to kind of solve it with Sony, but the woman from Sony that I had a phone call with told me, we don't deal with pirates. So that was really nice. Well, so I didn't have any chance but to actually remove the app, because otherwise they would probably have sued me. Yeah, I guess it's a difficult situation for Apple, because on the one hand, you don't want to get the impression that they are over-policing the App Store, but on the other side, you don't want to see them in the situation of ridicule when there's obvious fake apps on the App Store. So maybe a bit better training of the reviews, review people, or maybe a bit more common sense, like an obvious Nintendo app that just shouldn't be approved if it's just a set of screenshots. Other scam apps would just take a really good running game like Temple Run and publish something that has a similar name and maybe even similar icon, hoping to capitalize on people just clicking on the wrong one. That's also not really good sportsmanship. Now, if you want to stump an expert, here's something that happened to me last week that had me scratching my head. You can try to add an NS array to itself. There will be nothing to prevent you from doing that. But if you further down in your code, if the array is released or something, some object in the array is released, you get a really, really weird memory error. Fabio Chioini on Twitter suggested that this kind of exception we should call an NS inception, because in my case I had an array in an array in an array, and the last array I tried to make a member of itself, and then I got the problem. And you know, in the movie Inception, you have a dream in a dream in a dream, so that's an NS inception, in case you were wondering. There's an amazing ARC article that I also linked to in the show notes, including workarounds for most common migration problems. Can really recommend you go over this article if you are looking to start switching to ARC soon. Then there's this item that Apple sold more iOS devices in 2011 than all the Macs it had sold in 28 years. Asimco.com reported that. I find that quite interesting. It gives you a feeling how much faster the iOS business is growing than the Mac business. Because if you just take 1 year, 2011, and all the Macs that were sold in 28 years, and this number is larger, then basically that would tell me that iOS is growing more than 28 times at the speed of Macs. Just kind of makes you feel that you are in the right market if you're doing iOS development. Speaking of iOS development, I installed Xcode. I installed Mountain Lion on my secondary iMac I got myself a new 27-inch iMac this year, and so I had one 27-inch iMac from 2 years ago where I installed Mountain Lion on. It seems Xcode 4.3 does not like to run on that. So you would have to see if there is a newer version. There might or might not be one of these versions still under NDA on the developer side. But actually, one side note here, I found the general experience of Mountain Lion really enjoyable. I especially like how you now have dedicated apps for notes and for reminders, because previously notes I would see as strange emails in my IMAP inbox, and reminders I would see on my calendar. And I've got everything set up over IMAP, so I don't use iCloud for email and calendar and notes, and that works really well. So I'm looking forward to getting this functionality onto all of my Macs. So that's something I wanted to report. Apple announced that the weather in March is too cold to play in the sandbox. The requirement for Mac apps to implement sandboxing had been shifted to June 1st. And not just that, they also mentioned that existing apps won't have to add sandboxing. They did that, quote, to provide you with enough time to take advantage of new sandboxing entitlements available in OS 10, 10.7.3 and new APIs in Xcode 4.3, end quote. Which is a bit odd, because Xcode itself does not have any APIs as far as I know. Or might I be mistaken there? What we do know is that there's a new possibility to hold on to the permission of accessing a file or folder once you've gotten it. Documentation for this can be found in the developer forum, and there's a published frequently asked questions. Don McAllister from Screencasts Online has a request for you. More specifically, your iOS apps. He asks that you add an option in the settings to highlight touches on screen. So if you demo the app via AirPlay, to have something show where you touch the screen. He highlights PDF Pen by Smile Software as the first to do that, and it's a boon for everybody doing live demos of your apps, because then the people can see where on your device you are putting your finger. On the official Apple Dev Forum, Steve Weller asked if NSXML parser is thread safe, to which he got a response. Quote, NSXML parser is, in general, thread safe. The only gotcha is that prior to this fix, it didn't initialize the underlying libxml2 parser properly. If you're using NSXML parser for multiple threads and there is a chance that two threads might simultaneously start up parsers, you should work around this problem by initializing the libxml parser from the main thread prior to using NSXML parser at all. The routine to call is xml init parser. This problem was addressed in Mac OS 10.7 and iOS 5, end quote. So before iOS 5, you have to manually call XML init parser from libxml. Afterwards, you don't have to do that anymore. I also found it quite enlightening to learn that NSXML parser is indeed using libxml2 internally, just like my own HTML parser, DTHTML parser, which is also based on libxml2. This HTML parser can be found in the DT Foundation project of mine on GitHub. And that's it for the news. Today I've got a really special treat for you. You might have already seen him on the internet or on Twitter or maybe on one of the Apple events. Dave Verwer, I think that's how you say his name. He's from Shiny Development, and he's made himself quite a name recently with his iOS development newsletter, where each week he curates really fabulous topics. And he's on the show today and will tell us behind the scenes how is this newsletter coming together. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Oliver. How are you?
Hey, just tell us briefly who you are and what Shiny Development is.
Sure. So, as you say, my name's Dave Verwer. I run a company called Shiny Development, and we do primarily iOS developer training, really. So we run training courses in the UK and various other places that can kind of train other developers from other languages up on iOS. And we also build our own applications and publish those on the App Store, like the developers we train.
So are these entirely your own applications, or do you also do contract development?
Sure. So the apps that we are working on right now and the apps that we have produced are entirely ours. We used to do some contract development, but when the training was taking off, we were trying to do the training and client work and also our own apps. And what happens in that situation is that your own apps suffer. The client work is always taking priority over your apps. And then, of course, the training, that's very difficult to do anything else while you're training, because you have to be standing there in front of the people training them. So we took a decision a little while ago to stop doing client work and concentrate on the training and our own apps.
You keep saying we being Shiny Development, I guess. So
that's right. Yeah.
What's that composed of?
So yes, there's four of us in Shiny Development. Up until recently, it's just been myself and my business partner. But towards the end of last year, we took on an additional developer. And just last week, we had an artist start as well. So we're now four people, and that will beef up the apps side of the business a little bit, as well as the training.
So you have a resident artist.
We do. Yes, that was an interesting decision. I think that when you're building your own apps, that it's so important to have good design, not only visual design, but, you know, interaction design, and really thinking about design from the very beginning of the process. And if you use freelance designers like we have before, I mean, that's great, and it's better than having no external resource for that. But we took the decision that if we had someone on the team, then that process could be better as a whole, because design and the art would be thought about from day one.
True, because if you start out like I did, like many other people did, you're mostly doing your own design work, and the trap here is that you kind of fall in love with your own work, but if somebody really takes a hard look at what you produce, he might tell you, well, it's not up to snuff to other apps, you maybe should hire a designer, and then that's really hurtful. So let me ask you this, was it hard to find somebody who kind of matches your vision for Shiny Development and your apps?
Yes, it was really hard to find someone good, because I mean, you know, a lot of designers, they work freelance, and we were specifically looking for someone permanent. But I feel really happy with the person we've got. And as I say, it's early days, because he only actually started at the beginning of this week just gone. But we're really happy with who we've found for that.
All right. The second thing then that I'd be interested in, you said you moved from contract to your own apps. Care to mention a couple of these that people should check out on the App Store?
Sure. So we have probably the biggest app that we did was one called Balloons, and that's a little kind of social game almost, really, where you launch virtual helium balloons up from wherever you are using the app. So you pick a balloon, you write a little message on the tag of the balloon, and you can take a photograph and attach that to the balloon, and you send the balloon up into the air, and it starts to travel around the world. And then other people with the app can see if they could catch a balloon that's over their head right now, they could bring that balloon down, have a read of the messages on it, and add their own message and send it back on its way. So these balloons kind of, they bounce around the world meeting different people, and you get to track where your balloon went. It's kind of the equivalent of that, I don't know whether you did it when you were a kid, that you'd write your name and address on a piece of paper and attach it to a helium balloon, and if anyone found that, they'd post it back.
The last time I saw somebody do that was for a wedding.
Oh, okay.
So kind of the card asks people to, if they have any good wishes for the newlyweds.
That's nice,
To call them or to send them an email or something. Interesting. So how was it determined how the balloons are moving? Were there like kind of virtual winds? Did you have a server for that, or how did you?
Yeah, so we have a server for that. We wrote the back-end server for that as well. Because previously to Mac and iOS development, we actually did quite a lot of Rails development. So all of our back-end servers are all kind of written in Rails and Ruby.
These are the two words that I find that nowadays you can get the most bonus points for. So you just need to mention Ruby, and Rails, and suddenly you have all the people will clap and cheer. Yeah, you're a good guy.
And then if you put Ruby together with iOS, the crowd goes wild. So we built
second
the whole backend.
Second app?
The second app is, we have an app called Explore Flickr. That's a Flickr browser, basically. It helps you find the best photos on Flickr. So it uses their API to bring back the best photos of the day, and then you can then drill in and kind of do searches through Flickr and find the best photography on Flickr.
And there's a free app, right?
That one's a free application with an in-app purchase for some extra features. We've actually seen good success with that model, really. The free application keeps new people coming in through the door every single day. And then, you know, obviously a percentage of those people convert into paid users. And I think that's, well, it's worked really well for us, that.
But they call this the freemium model.
Yes, I think they do, yeah.
Do you have any kind of number, how many of the people downloading the free version will then also do an in-app purchase?
I mean, that completely depends on not only the price of your in-app purchase, and we've deliberately priced our in-app purchase, and I hesitate to say high because it's still only $5, but we've, whoa, you know, it's more than the 99 cent or the minimum price. So, but we convert about 5% of those people to
5%
of the app. Yeah,
that's amazing. I would have thought about kind of 0.7 to 1%, but 5% for that high price, yeah. It must be really something compelling that you're offering there in this.
I almost feel like a fraud because it's the beautiful photography on Flickr that I guess persuades people to upgrade. Although, you know, our application is a very, I believe, a very nice way to explore that photography. So I guess that's what we add. That's where we add the value.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right. Next topic: the training. How does this work out? Is it that I need training and I would call you and say, Dave, come over, show me how this works? Or what do you mean by you do training?
Sure, yeah. So we started this about 2.5 years ago now. We originally started by licensing some courseware from a company in America. We wanted to kind of dip our toe to see if there was a market for iOS training. And so rather than develop our own full course, which obviously takes a long time to develop, we licensed some courseware and we ran a couple of courses and we got... we got really good feedback from those courses, and we definitely saw that there was a market for those courses. And so I felt, though, that the courseware we'd licensed, while it was very good, it didn't really fit how I wanted to teach iOS development. Mm-hmm. And so we took the decision to develop our own set of courseware and start running our own training courses. Now, we run these publicly. So, you know, we schedule a course and people book onto that course individually, and then, you know, they turn up and we teach them. Or we also have had great success running in-house courses with companies that are looking to train up a team of people, or they have maybe the standard requirements then plus they're looking to do some project or other and they want to dig into that area of iOS in a slightly more deep way than you might cover on a public course. So we run it both publicly and in-house.
So for example, if I am a big company and I don't have anybody who knows, say, core data, we could ask you to do a core data course in-house and get the people up to speed on that.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, with things like that, we tend to, so after the basic course, we tend to, if people have specific needs, we tend to do kind of consultancy or a kind of advanced training around the topics they need, depending on the level of their developers. So if they've never done iOS before, then they're going to need to get the basics of iOS before they dive into something like Core Data or some of the more advanced topics. So, and actually, it's kind of ironic in that now, you know, a couple of years later, after we've had these course materials, I mean, they're constantly changing, but we've had these course materials now for a couple of years, and we're actually licensing our course materials out to other companies now, which is a nice kind of circular back to where we started, really.
Mm-hmm. So whereabouts do you do your courses? Are these kind of international or in Europe or in your neck of the woods?
It's the public courses we do are all in the UK. So we do a course in Manchester and we do a course in London. But then the in-house courses, they can be anywhere, you know, mainly in the UK, but Europe and elsewhere as well.
Mm-hmm. I think the UK has quite a lively iOS development scene, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. I think these days everywhere has a lively.
Well, speaking of which, are you going to come to NS Conference?
Yes, I do have my ticket for NS Conference, and we'll also be bringing the other developer from our company as well. So there'll be two of us there from Shiny.
Hey, cool. I will be there as well.
Fantastic. Yeah, it'll be good to see you. It's a great little conference. I've been to that conference actually every year since it started, so it's always been a cracking little conference that.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to it. It's the first time that I go. Last year I went to WWDC. It was the first time going there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite interesting to see how these conferences are kind of differently organized, but still you always kind of meet the same people. There's like a handful, kind of maybe less than 100 people or so worldwide that you see at all the conferences.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a strong community that we have here, and a really good community in the UK as well. And I think when you come to NS Conference, I think you'll see a lot of that community.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of community, let's get to the thing that we are really interested in. Now we know who you are and what you do. But I would really like to know, how did you come up with the idea to do a weekly newsletter, and how do you manage to get this amazing quality?
Well, that's very kind of you to say. The idea isn't new at all. In fact, I am not even going to attempt to claim the idea as my own.
There have been newsletters before. Yes,
yeah, but
that
even,
you
even
do
very
a
specific,
newsletter.
Development newsletters. I was subscribed to a newsletter called Ruby Weekly, and that's run by a guy called Peter Cooper. He's also in the UK, and I know Peter from when I used to do a lot more Ruby. And so he runs Ruby Weekly, and he runs JavaScript Weekly, and a couple of others, I think. And I really like the format, and I like the fact that it came through on email, because, you know, a lot of people ask the question, well, why email? Why not do it as an RSS feed or whatever? But I actually really...
Actually, I have a question.
Sure.
Why email?
Why email?
Yeah, everything is blogs, and I get my news mostly on Twitter. I'm following like 800 people who are kind of the core, it seems.
Sure.
But it kind of really astonished me, or kind of surprised me, that when I heard about what you did, that's something that nowadays you would do, because email is spam, isn't it?
Well, not if you do it right, I don't think. The problem with Twitter and RSS and things like that is it's really easy to let them pass you by. Mm-hmm. It's really easy to miss stuff on Twitter. It's really easy to ignore your RSS feeds for a couple of weeks, and you miss that news that you would have found interesting. With an email, it is more intrusive. You know, it's going to land in your email inbox every Friday at 3 o'clock. And as long as the content of that email is concise and only has the information that people actually want to read and is good quality information, people won't find that to be spam. And it's intentional that it kind of interrupts you a little bit, because it draws your attention to this week's news, and is something which is a little bit harder to just let you pass you by. So it was a very deliberate decision to do it over email. I've seen, you know, people really like that kind of regular time slot. In fact, on Twitter, it's become almost a bit of a joke that, you know, my email announces the start of the weekend, because, you know, 3 o'clock on Friday, people are starting to wind down for the weekend. And I picked that time slot deliberately because people will be kind of finishing up with the week at that point, and maybe enjoy reading a little bit of news.
Oh my, the sheer psychology of this newsletter is amazing. But let me give you a feedback here. Sure. I try to practice inbox zero. Okay. And what usually happens is I get emails, it's got delete, nothing to do, archive, okay, quick response, mm-hmm. two lines, yours sincerely, Oliver, archive. But the thing that remains in my inbox at the end of the week, because it's not something I can deal with in like 30 seconds,
sure.
and it's not something that I want to archive, because archive means I'm not going to look at it anymore. Is your newsletter?
Well, I mean, that's a great compliment. Thank you. The fact that my newsletter survives your cull of the inbox. I mean, I work in a very similar way to you. With my email inbox, I try and get everything out of my email inbox as soon as I can. Hopefully it is kind of one that can stay there until you have a few minutes to read some of the links in it.
Mm-hmm. And fabulous content. Yeah, I get like with my streaming approach, that is scanning Twitter and having a couple of RSS feeds on my Flipboard. I think I get about a third to 50% of what you get, and you have really the gems. Yeah, where I say, where did he get that from? So. Can you shed some light? Where do you get this content from if you're not scanning your Twitter all the time?
Yeah. So the content comes from various different places, really. Definitely Twitter is a source of content. I see people linking to articles on Twitter. I see people talking about articles on Twitter. And what I'll do is I use a tool called Pinboard. I don't know if you've heard of Pinboard. It's a web-based bookmarking service. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the Delicious service by...
Yeah.
So it's basically the same as Delicious. So I can either email links to Pinboard, or I can book, if I'm on my desktop machine, I can bookmark them right there. And so I get links from Twitter. I also have my own collection of RSS feeds, which... it's something that I was guilty, as everyone is, of kind of letting those slide for a few weeks, and then you go back and you had 1,000 unread items, and you know, you'd hit mark all as read and then start again. Mm-hmm. Doing this newsletter has actually made me much better at keeping up with the news myself, because obviously every Thursday evening I'm having to come up with a whole load of hopefully interesting links. So it's actually made me much more disciplined about reading RSS, you know, regularly keeping up with what's going on there. And then also people who subscribe to the email now send me interesting links through, you know, email or Twitter or something like that. So really those three places are where I get all of the links. And over the week, I might gather up maybe 15 to 20 links on Pinboard. And on a Thursday evening, usually I get those that list of 15, 20 links and start narrowing down which ones I actually want to link to in the Friday email.
Mm-hmm. So are there links that didn't quite make it into the newsletter?
There are. I think that's actually one of the important points about the newsletter is that it's not everything that I found. It's hopefully the most interesting things that I found that week. And a lot of those links will be like the new links for that week. They'll have been published during the week. But occasionally I'll link something in there that is maybe, you know, even a couple of years old, but that I just came across that week because, and I found it interesting. And so other people may find it interesting as well. So it's as much about the links that I leave out as the links that I include.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that it's kind of a Apple style. Know what to omit.
You've got to make a decision there, and sometimes you might get that decision right, and sometimes maybe not so right. But it certainly seems from the feedback people are giving that people are enjoying my take on the kind of news for the week.
You go ahead.
That was another thing, actually, that when I started to put this newsletter together, I thought, well, maybe I should do it through the company or and have it as, you know, shiny development news or something like that. But I really wanted it to be, it's my personal take, not particularly the company's take. It's just my personal take on what I find interesting. And that's why every week the email doesn't come from some company that you've probably never heard of. It comes from a person who is applying just their own opinion on the links. I thought that was really important as well, to kind of give it that personal touch.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to say, speaking about feedback, mm-hmm. Care to share some stats?
Sure. So we have about 2,300 subscribers right now. That started really well. Within the first week, I think we were at 700 subscribers.
From 0 to 700 in 1 week.
In 1 week, yeah. And I don't really know how that happened. I mean, I tweeted it and several other people retweeted it. And so that obviously got it to a fairly large audience immediately. But I was amazed that 700 people signed up without even being able to see the first issue. You know, they just signed up blind, basically.
So did I. And so did a couple of people that I said, you're going to have to subscribe to that. If you're not following Twitter or reading any RSS feeds, this is the news that you need so that we can speak about these things next week.
And so hopefully the fact that it wasn't a company, I think if we had done this through the company, we would have got nowhere near 700 people signed up in that first week. I think because it is my personal view, and you know, I've been on Twitter for a long time now, and hopefully people some people would kind of maybe recognize my name or something like that from Twitter. I think that probably helped the initial sign up, and then it's grown steadily over the last 6 months or so to about 2,300 subscribers. Mm-hmm. Now
I think it also might have to do with if it's your personal name, people wouldn't assume that it's somehow commercial.
Sure.
If it's a company name, then people would assume, he's probably going to talk about his company every other newsletter, or even more often than that. Or maybe you would do sort of advertisement.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's you personally, then there might just be the sweet spot where you don't spend enough time on it so that you have to make it worth your while and make you some money. If it's just like a little bit here and a little bit there, collecting some links and then curating them in 1 hour or so on Thursday, send out the newsletter, you don't need to make money with that. But if if it's professional and you have a staff maybe and you have editors and so on,
of course,
they need sponsorship and. Yeah. That's actually what people are not interested in.
Sure.
Now that iOS development becomes more and more a market of its own, there are companies springing up left and right to try to sell you something.
Sure.
Like the next statistic thing, the next scheme, how to increase your ranks, to promote your apps, do whatever. There's this old adage. If there's a gold rush, the guys who make the most money are the ones who sell the shovels and pickaxes.
I use that quote actually about the training we run. You know, it's the same thing. So to provide that service is very valuable. And it's, you know, from the very beginning, it's had no commercial sponsorship or no commercial links at all. That's not to say that we might not do that at some point in the future, but that's certainly not the plan to turn this into a heavily commercial commercial thing. So it's me. It's a personal view on the week's news, and we'll go from there.
Mm-hmm. So you're not categorically excluding the possibility that there will be some advertisement in the future.
It's not something I'm particularly thinking about at the moment, but I would be foolish to say that we'll never do it. I can say that if we do ever do it, or if I do ever do it, that will be very carefully done, and it won't just be some random advert for, you know, whatever is happy to pay a few dollars for advertisements. It will be links that I really like, and they'll be clearly marked as sponsored links. But to be honest, that's not even something I'm considering at the moment.
Well, I think sooner rather than later you will be approached, even by me. Yeah, you please tell your subscribers about our app Linguan, which is the perfect tool to localize apps, and then you will be forced to make a decision, pro or contra.
So that happened very quickly, actually. Within 2 or 3 weeks, we were receiving kind of people saying, do you do advertisements? Do you do sponsored links? Or maybe even not so blatant as that, but, you know, here's my tool or my app. Would you please link to it? That happened. That happened very quickly, actually.
What did you do about that?
So we haven't, as I say, I haven't taken any of those things up. I mean, occasionally those people who send me their product or whatever, if I really like it, then it'll go in just as a normal link because I found out about it, but there's been no commercial sponsorship at all.
So could we summarize, if you want your product put into let's rephrase. If I wanted to get the interest of your audience, I would have to package it in an interesting article that you would link to, rather than basically just being a banner ad.
Oh, absolutely, a banner ad or something like that. I'm not going to link to things like that. Mm-hmm. If you make an interesting article and it includes some links to your products, that's okay. I tend to rate. So let's say two people email me with a link. Mm-hmm. If one person has emailed me a link by somebody else, then that's going to have a higher rating with me than if you've emailed me something that you've done personally.
You are just like Google. that's PageRank.
But that's not to say that I won't find what you've done personally interesting and won't link to it. So, you know, it's no it's not to say that I definitely won't link to people if you're just purely promoting your own stuff. It's a mix. It's whether I find it interesting, and that's why that's what it comes down to at the end of the day. Do I find the content interesting, and do I think the people who are subscribed will find it interesting?
Mm. Well, I try really hard to write interesting articles, so I hope to be seeing some links to those in the future as well.
I think I've linked to your blog a couple of times, actually.
A couple of times.
Yeah, there we go.
Oh, that actually brandishes me as a liar, because if I were reading your newsletter, like I said I do, then I would have spotted the links.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it doesn't matter if you don't read it every week. It doesn't matter if you take a quick skim of it and don't click any of the links. That's no problem at all.
Wait, do you keep some sort of archive if somebody misses it?
On iosdevweekly.com, you can see the full archive of every issue that's been sent out. Mm-hmm. And that's updated as the newsletter goes out. So it's always there with a full archive.
Mm. What tools do you actually use to put that together? I'm wondering.
So I use a tool called Jekyll, which is a Ruby static.
Ruby, yeah.
Oh, you know it?
No, but you said the Ruby word. Ruby, yeah.
So I use this tool called Jekyll, which is a static site generator written in Ruby. So it's locally on your own machine. It takes a whole load of Markdown files and some templates and spits out, again, locally on your machine, a bunch of HTML files, which is the website. That then gets uploaded to the web server. Again, I use a tool called Capistrano to automate that uploading. And so in 3 seconds, I can go from the Markdown file that I write the newsletter in to having the site completely updated with the plain text version, the email version, and the website version all in one.
Wait. There are 3 versions: plain text, website, and then an email newsletter.
That's right. Yeah. So they're all based around the same Markdown source files.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is, obviously, for the website, we need a slightly different layout. For the email, it needs to be formatted so that the email clients can read it, because email clients are fairly primitive in their support for HTML.
Mm.
So there needs to be another template for the email. And then finally, a lot of people don't have or have switched off HTML email. So I also produce a plain text version, again, from the same source.
Okay, that goes into the same email.
Yeah, so if
it's like this, if your browser doesn't support, then you're going to see this text.
That's right.
Kind of thing. So fallback, if no text HTML MIME type is supported, then it goes to the text, and so you still see the contents.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Uh-huh. So all 3 of those get generated on the website, and then I use a tool called MailChimp, which is an online service for distributing email to lists of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go create a new campaign in MailChimp. They ask me for the HTML source for the email. They ask me for the plain text version, which I generate through the website. And then I can schedule that email to go out at a specific time as well. Because, as I said, the kind of 3 o'clock on a, well, 3 o'clock for the UK people, I guess 4 o'clock for Europeans, and it, kind of early to mid morning for the Americans. The same time every week, the email goes out exactly on 3 o'clock UK time. So I can schedule it. I can prepare it in advance. If I'm maybe busy on a Thursday night, I might prepare it on a Wednesday night. And then I can schedule it so that I can have that email sent without me having to press any buttons at all. In fact, there was one time I was speaking at a conference, and at the beginning of my talk, I gave the newsletter a little plug, and I just said, you know, if you're interested in this, you should sign up. And then while I was on stage, before the end of my talk, that week's newsletter actually went out, and some people who had been sat in the talk and signed up, then, you know, before I'd even stopped talking, they'd actually received that week's, which got some interesting questions at the end. Yeah,
that's funny.
So MailChimp is what I use to send that out, and a kind of Jekyll site to
build. Is this MailChimp, you have to pay for that?
Yes, it's a paid service. I mean, you can do a free service with it, but they add an advertisement for their own service at the bottom of the free one. Again, the same concept with not including commercial links in it. I don't really want to link to MailChimp every week. So for me, yes, it's a cost to that, and there is a financial as well as a time cost to this, although it's fairly small. It was worth paying for that service, and
Well, time is money.
of course,
So, how much of a cost are you actually eating here for people getting a free curated newsletter?
yeah. So it's hard to say exactly how long it takes me because a lot of the week will just be a few minutes here and there collecting links. But I kind of would do that anyway, so I almost ignore that time because I need to keep up with what's happening in the iOS development world. And so I kind of write that time off as, that's just something I do to keep my knowledge up to date.
All right.
It then takes me an hour or two on an evening, usually Thursday evening, where I put the newsletter together and upload it to MailChimp. So it takes me a couple of hours a week to do
So
this.
let's say 2 or 3 hours, and how much is MailChimp?
MailChimp at the moment, I think we're paying $30 a month.
$30 a month, so say roughly $7 a week, and then it would take 3 hours by your rate. So I'd say that's kind of $0.20 or so per subscriber that everybody gets for free.
If you all want to PayPal me 20 cents each, then
Well,
no.
would that be another model? Because there are some newsletters or podcasts that work on kind of donations accepted basis. Is there something
Possibly,
you
yeah.
would be interested in doing?
I mean, like I say, at the moment, it's just something I'm doing, and
For the fun of that.
I'm not particularly. I enjoy keeping myself up to date with it. I enjoy the feedback from people. It's great to hear that people are enjoying it, and the feedback has been fantastic so far. People really seem to love it, which is great. So I'm not really, as I say, I'm not really thinking about it commercially right now.
Well, and there's the social aspect, because if people know you as the guy who knows stuff, they will want to stand around you at conferences and kind of just listen what wise things you have to say.
And if people happen to research, well, who's doing this, and they find that I run a training company and they book on a training course, that's also great. But it's a side product of it rather than But absolutely, I mean, it's always good to increase your profile within the community. It's all good, really.
So we should always leave people with a couple of things that they should do right away, kind of action items. So I guess we should tell them about what's it, iosdevelopment.com? No,
It
what's
was
it?
iosdevweekly.com.
So go to iosdevweekly.com and sign up. And also, do you do Twitter? Probably.
I do Twitter. Yeah, my Twitter name is Dave Verwer. That's Verwer because nobody can ever spell my surname.
Yeah, neither could I. All right, and I put these items in the show notes. And your company is shinydevelopment.com.
That's correct, yeah.
All right, so going to mention these. Well, it's really been a pleasure talking to you, Dave. I think we kind of covered about everything there is for the newsletter.
Great.
Really been a fabulous honor for me to have you on the show. And maybe I can convince you in one of the future shows to come back and give us an update on how your newsletter is doing, maybe what news there are that you kind of scrape together from the cutting room floor.
You want a sneak peek, the peek of next week's newsletter?
Ah, do you have a sneak peek?
That would be great. And thank you for having me on.
All right. Okay, you meant for the next item.
Oh
Next time.
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So that will be cool. I'm always kind of trying to record on Friday, Saturday, or so on. So maybe you would always already have a couple of items that people would then have kind of an idea what to expect the following Friday.
Sure.
So, been a pleasure. Thank you for coming.
And I guess I will see you at NS Conference.
NS Conference it is.
Yeah.